This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. You've probably heard about the Washington side of Fast and Furious. Yesterday, a House committee voted to hold Attorney General Eric Holder in contempt of Congress, and President Obama invoked executive privilege to protect disputed documents. House Republicans say the Attorney General and now the President are trying to cover up the fallout from a bungled gun sting on the Mexico-Arizona border. Democrats say it's all election year politics. But let's step back to 2009, when the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives created Fast and Furious as part of an effort to stem the flow of U.S. weapons to Mexican gangs and drug cartels. What was the intent? What's the scale of the problem? What went wrong? And what happens now? If you have questions about Fast and Furious or gun running to Mexico, give us a call. 800-989-8255 is the phone number. Email talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation at our website. That's npr.org. Later in the program, Loving Prize winner Reginald Daniel joins us to talk about teaching multiracial identity in a changing world. But first, NPR National Desk correspondent Ted Robbins joins us from his office in Tucson, where he covers the Southwest. And nice to have you back on the program.
Hi, Neil. It's good to be with you.
And what was Fast and Furious?
Well, Fast and Furious, let's go back even a little farther, if we might.
Okay.
Because really, it was only one program in a series of sting operations called gunwalking, essentially, which began in 2006 and ended in 2011. And so it was part of, I guess the umbrella would be Project Gunrunner, and it was supposed to stem the number of firearms that were leaving the United States and going into Mexico into the hands of drug cartel members, largely because it is much easier to obtain guns in the United States than it is in Mexico, which has some fairly stringent, at least legal, you know, ways to get guns. It's fairly stringent gun control laws. So what they would do is, instead of actually arresting a person who bought a gun as a straw purchaser, bought a gun for somebody else, which is illegal in the United States. That's the way it works. And then they hand them over and then they walk them into Mexico. So instead of arresting somebody, we're talking about ATF right now, they would let the purchaser walk and, in this case, take the guns, meaning gun walking, take the guns into Mexico in hopes of arresting the people who they gave the guns to, so leading them to bigger targets in the cartel operations. That was the intention of Fast and Furious, as I say, which was one of a number of these kinds of operations, which actually began under the Bush administration.
And gun walking as opposed to gun running. When the ATF does it, it's gun walking. And if it's done purely illegally, it's gun running. What's the scale of the problem? Obviously, the United States provides a lot of assistance to the Mexican government and the Mexican army. Are we essentially arming both sides in the drug wars in Mexico?
Well, by we, I mean we're arming one side, the army and the police. The government is helping with aid, and the other side is being armed illegally by a number of American gun dealers. Not that they're doing anything illegally, mind you. Some are, but a lot of them are not. So yeah, you could say that we as a country are.
And so, obviously, tens of thousands of people have died in the drug wars in Mexico. Joining us now from member station KUAZ in Tucson is Michelle Marisco, Tucson senior field correspondent for the Fronteras Desk, a collaboration of public radio stations across the Southwest. And it's good of you to be with us today.
Thank you very much, Neil.
And tell us a little about these gangs the ATF was trying to track down.
From the number of guns and where the guns were going, the ATF was trying to land somebody in the Sinaloa cartel. The Sinaloa cartel has been going after the Zeta cartel in northeastern Mexico, the Gulf cartel, the Juarez cartel in Ciudad Juarez, and for a certain number of years, they were also going after the Arellano Felix organization in Tijuana. So virtually throughout all of Mexico. Now, where the guns were ending up seemed to always be in the hands of people working for the Sinaloa cartel, whether the guns were being seized by the Mexican army in Tijuana, here on the Arizona border, or in Mexico. Over and over again, the guns kept landing in the hands of one particular cartel.
And it's obviously a risk allowing those guns to go through. They can cause problems. They presumably get used.
They did, and ostensibly this was the purpose of Operation Fast and Furious and its predecessor, Operation Wide Receiver. And in Fast and Furious, of course, two of the guns found at the murder scene aboard a patrol agent, Brian Terry, were Fast and Furious guns. It's unknown whether they were actually used to commit the murder. The FBI ballistics report was inconclusive on this. But the guns were also being found in the hands of Sinaloa cartel members. For example, in Juarez, they were used to kill the brother of a high-level attorney general for the state of Chihuahua. And, of course, this is all going on at a time when the United States is trying to coordinate with the Mexican government after the Mérida Initiative to implement certain types of priorities in Mexico's handling of organized crime cases. So while that's going on, they ended up allowing these guns to be smuggled into Mexico, and then they were used to kill this attorney general's family member.
And Ted Robbins, clearly that's not the intent. What went wrong here?
Well, what went wrong is it was, as I think, you know, as almost everybody admits right now, it was a flawed plan. They really couldn't adequately track the firearms once they went into Mexico.
Let's see. We get a caller in on the conversation. Let's go to Daryl. And Daryl's with us from Lake Worth in Florida.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I guess I'm just a little confused as to the logic behind a plan to stop guns going into Mexico by sending this huge number of guns into Mexico. I'm flummoxed by it.
Why did they use so many guns, Ted Robbins?
Well, I mean, they did. Most of the guns that are taken into Mexico are not weren't part of this. I mean, they're being gun, as you had said earlier, it's gun running and it's illegal, and mm-hmm. and they don't know about it. Our government, that is.
Well, how many guns were involved in Fast and Furious?
But Michelle might have a better. I think it was something like 1,600. Is that right?
Yeah, it was roughly 1,800, mostly AK-47 variants, but also 50 caliber rifles, which are, you know, a bullet the size of a small beer bottle.
Yeah. So the standard. You know, the standard training was to follow the straw purchasers to where they hand it off to the cartel members and then arrest everybody and seize the guns. And they just lost track in this operation.
And obviously things, disaster ensued. Daryl, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
Let's go next to, this is Richard. Richard with us from Salt Lake City.
Yeah. My question is, how much did the Mexican government know about this? Because if somebody was running guns into America to feed our criminals, that just stinks. I don't know. How much did they know, the Mexican government?
Michelle Mariska, can you help us with that?
The previous attorney general for Mexico had reportedly been briefed on Fast and Furious and gun walking. He's now a diplomat in another country. He's an ambassador, ostensibly. He has said that he did not know. Mexico has pounded on the table saying that they are shocked and disappointed with the United States, but it did appear that at least some people, including that former attorney general, had been briefed on the ATF's idea. But it's also interesting to note that ATF agents working in Mexico had no idea what ATF in Phoenix had been up to at the time.
So different branches of ATF weren't talking to each other.
Right. I mean, and this we kept seeing this throughout the entire case. For example, in 2009, the lead Fast and Furious suspect had been picked up by the ATF, gave him a business card, and tried to recruit him to work for them to nail two Mexican drug lords. It turned out the two drug lords that he was supposed to be working as a snitch on were informants for the FBI. And in all this, the DEA was also involved running camera, pole cameras, they call them, on these same two suspects. So really we had I do not know how many suspects that were working for either the ATF, the FBI, the DEA, and in some cases, all three, being involved in this fiasco.
And they still lost track of the guns.
Yes, sir.
All right. Thanks very much for the call, Richard. This email question you mentioned earlier, there was an earlier project in the Bush administration. Gloria wants to know, how does Fast and Furious differ from the Project Gunrunner in the Bush administration? Ted Robbins, do you know?
Yeah, they got caught in the sense that it came to light. Fast and Furious came to light only because, there were a number of guns that were traced, and ATF agents were voicing opposition. But really, all of this came to light because of the death of Border Patrol agent Brian Terry just over this side of the border, which was arguably, he was arguably shot by a couple of the guns allowed to walk. And that that really brought this to light. And I think an ATF agent named John Dotson and another were upset at this operation. And they had reached out to superiors in ATF, and finally they went to Congress, and they went especially to Senator Grassley of Iowa and then Representative Daryl Issa. And they started complaining about this tactic, and that's really how it came to light.
Were similar numbers of weapons involved in the Bush administration?
I don't know the answer to that.
All right.
I know that there were no prosecutions during the Bush operations, and there were prosecutions during when Obama took office.
We're talking about Fast and Furious, what went wrong with the operation and the gun running problem it was designed to target. If you have questions about it, give us a call. 800-989-8255. The email address is talk@npr.org. We're speaking with Ted Robbins at NPR's National Desk Correspondent in Tucson, and also with Michelle Marisco, Senior Tucson Field Correspondent for the Fronteras Desk. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Neil Conan. Attorney General Eric Holder and House Republicans signaled a willingness to negotiate a way out of their standoff over the investigation into Fast and Furious. That would keep the power struggle out of the courts and avoid a contempt charge against the Attorney General. That's the political fallout. Today we're talking about the Fast and Furious operation itself, what it was designed to do, and how it went wrong. If you have questions about Fast and Furious or about gun running to Mexico, give us a call. 800-989-8255. The email address is talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation at our website, npr.org. Our guests are Ted Robbins, NPR's National Desk Correspondent, who's based in Tucson, and Michelle Marisco, Senior Tucson Field Correspondent for the Fronteras Desk, a collaboration of public radio stations across the Southwest, where they cover the border, immigration, and the changing demographics of the border region. And this is an email from Joshua in Indiana, who's following up on what you just said, Ted Robbins. And is it true there have been no prosecutions of gun runners resulting from the botched operation?
Let me back up actually to the previous caller, that according to the sources during our break that I looked at, that Fast and Furious was by far the largest sale of firearms under these gun walking programs. There's been one actual conviction of a gun runner under these programs. And Michelle might have more.
Michelle?
There was a ring run by the guy by the name of Manuel Celis Acosta. There were four people there who were eventually sentenced in Operation Fast and Furious. And then, of course, there's the predecessor case, Operation Wide Receiver, which started in 06. And in that case, there were 11 defendants. And of those 11, nearly all have pleaded out at this point, and their cases have been adjudicated.
Let's go next to, this is Ren. Ren with us from Ann Arbor.
Good day. Just a few questions. This entire operation is termed by many commentators in the media as botched. But here we have this most recent statement of one of your guests that there were 11 prosecutions, wide receiver. Then a much larger operation is conceived and rolled out with hardly anyone in other agencies knowing about it, where 1,800 weapons, a much larger number, go out with such a terrible track record on the first one, 11 prosecutions, and then a single conviction or, you know, this is incredible that AK-47s, let me ask just the question, how could AK-47s be sold here in the United States with assault weapon ban? How could, why were they not tagged, RFIDs? You could tag a box of cornflakes and trace it across continental distances. What was going on? This is, to me, is an out-of-control agency, completely berserk.
RFIDs are very short range, but they could have put a GPS device or something on it. Ted Robbins, do you have any answers for Wren?
You know, I recall testimony on the Hill of one of the ATF agents who was critical of this operation, saying that they had put GPS devices on some of these, and that the batteries ran out, and they hadn't thought of that when they did it. So when they, you know, again, I mean, the parts of, in terms of botched, it's a shorthand way of saying it. It didn't work.
Michel Marisco, do we know whose idea this was?
Well, there's the million-dollar question everybody's trying to figure out. The U.S. attorney in Arizona took the blame. He resigned as a result of the scandal. The ATF chief at the time in Phoenix told reporters emphatically no, there was no gun walking going on. He was quietly, laterally transferred back to Washington as a result of this. Now, going back to wide receiver, because I've always had questions about this. See, when they started the prosecutions of those people in that case, they brought in a special prosecutor from Washington, D.C. to handle the prosecutions here in Tucson. In other words, prosecutors here didn't handle it. She did, from D.C. So what happened there? Defense attorneys tell me she had to have known because she talked to all the agents. She knew all the parts of the program. And in wide receiver, they clearly knew, the court documents stated, that these suspects had been going into Mexico with guns and coming back into the U.S. to buy more from snitches here in Tucson. So at the end of the day, the question becomes, okay, if you brought in a special prosecutor from D.C. to handle these prosecutions quietly in Tucson, who was her boss? How did he not know? Who approved her travel to Tucson from Washington to handle this? And these are the questions that, you know, House Republicans are trying to find out right now.
And Ted Robbins, another part of Wren's question, sales of AK-47s?
Well, they're not, as long as they're not sold as fully automatic, they're not illegal. And then they can be easily, I don't know how easily, but they can be converted. And it's also not, it's not illegal to buy these guns. It's illegal to buy them in somebody else's name. In terms of tracing, you know, there were gun dealers who were worried about this, who took part in it and worked along with the ATF. There are reputable gun dealers who will not sell if they have any suspicions that this is going on in the Tucson area and Phoenix area and in Texas as well. But some of these people were actually, you know, some of the dealers were working with the ATF. So I don't think you can put it on the dealers for selling the guns.
This AK-47 is what's called a select fire weapon, Wren. There are switches, as manufactured, switches for single shot when you pull the trigger, or a burst of three, or then fully automatic. They are, as sold in this country, only supposed to be the single shot version, but there are kits available that you can adapt it, as Ted Robbins said, to back to the full select fire options.
Indeed. And, well, thank you for taking my questions. I just wanted to make a point that hundreds and hundreds of these weapons still out there, we can only conclude after 300 Mexican citizens have been killed with them that the rate of killings will continue at one every two or three days. That's the arithmetic rate of killings under this program, and it's got to be continuing.
All right, Wren, thanks very much for the phone call.
I should say that over the last couple of years, Customs and Border Protection has really ramped up its operations at the ports of entry in terms of southbound cargo. They're now inspecting. They get a lot more cash than firearms, but they get a fair amount of firearms going south as well. And that's only been in the last few years.
Let's go next to this is. There she is, Lynn. Lynn with us from Peoria.
Hi. I'm wondering, does an operation like this, even under the best of circumstances, does it succeed in really dealing a blow to the cartels? Does it get anybody high up in them, or does it just get these boot soldiers on, you know, the peons of the operation?
Well, Michelle Marisco, as I understand it, that was the design here, that instead of just getting those straw buyers, the foot soldiers, the idea was to go higher up the chain.
Great, great question, and this comes back to so much of the criticism. No, they've never landed anybody. Manuel Celis Acosta, who was the leader of the gun buying ring in Phoenix, is the biggest proverbial fish that they landed. And keep in mind that, you know, he was supposed to be working as a snitch against two suspects who were working as snitches for the FBI. So at the end of the day, you know, no major arrests had ever resulted from either Operation Fast and Furious or Operation Wide Receiver. None.
So why are they doing it?
Well, that's a great question. I'm afraid I don't have an answer for you on that.
Well, they're not anymore.
They say they're not. They said they weren't doing it when they were doing it.
Thank you, Neil.
They did say they were not doing it back in when Brian Terry was first killed, and later on they ended up having to retract quite a few statements as a result of that.
Thank you very much, Lynn.
Thank you.
Here's an email question from Colin in Palo Alto. I have a question and a comment. Firstly, how many of the people who worked on Operation Wide Receiver were also involved in Fast and Furious? Is this a case of institutional continuity where the same people were making the same decisions? We'll get that part. Michelle Marisco?
Yeah, when you look at the structure of who's in charge of these operations, the U.S. Attorney's Office in Arizona under Dennis Burke, and also under Paul Charlton, who was the former U.S. attorney terminated by the Bush administration. And then the ATF at the time had many of those same people in charge of their office in Phoenix and in Tucson. So ostensibly, we have the same people. Who was on the ground at the time? I'm afraid I don't have an answer for you there because court documents will not reveal people.
And the second part of Colin's email, I ask this because it seems like changing the administration, even the head of the ATF, has had no effect on what the agency does. As such, it begs the question of whether or not any executive branch can effectively manage the ATF or other branches. Ted Robbins, is the ATF out of control?
That's a loaded statement to say they're out of control, but I think it's calls into question federal bureaucracy, that once you get a ball rolling, it's a lot harder to stop. So, I mean, clearly there was a lack, and I think even they would admit, the ATF that is, there was a lack of internal responsiveness to critics, and there was a lack of what bureaucrats call outcome-based decisions.
Here's an email question. This is from Rick. I think the Obama administration used Fast and Furious and as an existing program to make an attempt to force new restrictive gun rules on U.S. gun owners. As he says, like Obama said, keep gun control under the radar. Michelle Marisco, is there any evidence of that?
Well, I don't know about evidence, but when you look at the timeline of events, in 2008, Bill Newell, and he was the head of the ATF during Fast and Furious, came out to say that 90% of the guns being used in Mexican killings came from the U.S. What he should have said was 90% of the guns that were seized in Mexico that were used in crimes came from the U.S. They don't know how many guns were actually used, obviously.
And traced, seized and traced.
Exactly. And when, as a result of that statement, and of course that went like wildfire, but as a result of that statement, he kept pushing this mandate. Now last summer, the Obama administration started a reporting requirement for anybody trying to buy more than two rifles in a border state. And more of these types of questions started coming up because at the end of the day, I don't know that they meant to implement this as a way to create gun control in border states, but the argument can certainly be made that that's what happened as a result of this.
So there were new restrictions promulgated?
Yes. A federal judge only recently ruled in the Obama administration's favor that the that they could uphold that they could enforce these new federal rules for gun dealers in the four border states.
We're talking with Michel Marisco, the Tucson senior field correspondent for the Fronteras Desk, and NPR's Ted Robbins is also with us. They're both in Tucson. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And Ted Robbins, you said earlier that the dealers themselves, in some cases, were working with the ATF, but that some may have been violating the law. Were there any instances of gun dealers, wink, wink, nod, nod, here's a case of AK-47s?
There have been prosecutions, but I'm not sure that they were under Fast and Furious. I mean, there have been a number of dealers prosecuted in border states for allowing straw purchases, illegal straw purchases. I don't know, Michel, do you know if there were any actually connected with these, with the gun walking operations?
No, there were not. The only gun dealers that have surfaced publicly were both snitches working for the ATF, running wiretaps on suspects for the ATF, and obviously neither of those had been convicted.
Let's see if we can get GE on the line. GE with us from Denton, Kansas.
Yes, sir. Even if the Mexican drug cartel does get illegal weapons from the United States, which I disagree with, but what stops the drug cartel, which has a lot of money, obviously, from getting weapons from China or other third world? Well, they're not third world anymore.
No, they're not.
But they're not really going to care who they send weapons to. Because, I mean, we've obviously had products come from China that had contained lead and this, that, and the other. So that's my question, sir.
Ted Robbins, can you help us out? Is the United States the largest supplier of illegal weapons to Mexico, and are other countries providing weapons?
Well, I mean, the United States is a large weapons provider legally to the world. I mean, this is one of our larger, not in terms of money, but it is certainly one of our, in terms of the rest of the world, we supply guns to, you know, we sell guns. I mean, this is one of our manufacturing industries. So, and they're on the border, let's face it. I mean, it's pretty easy to get the guns across the border as opposed to putting it on a ship from China. But I think there's been plenty of evidence of things like grenades, for instance, coming from other countries. I think the caller's right that they're getting guns from places other than the United States as well.
Thanks very much.
Neil, if I could add to that really quick.
Sure.
Because the ATF just released some data, but as you'll see in a second, it's inconclusive. Between 2007 and 2011, there were 99,000 guns seized in Mexico, turned over to the ATF for tracing. Two-thirds of those came from the United States. However, what Mexico would not tell ATF was exactly how many guns they actually seized. All we know is that they turned over 100,000 to ATF for tracing. And so it always adds to more of this mystery, more of this enigma, exactly what percentage of the guns in Mexico are actually coming from the U.S. We don't know. And ATF and Mexico are not telling us.
And we have a pretty clear image in our heads of what it looks like coming north from Mexico into the United States. What is it like going the other way? As Ted mentioned, they're seizing a lot of money and a lot of weapons, too. Michel?
Yes. What they have is these outbound inspection teams standing at each port of entry, and they're randomly searching people. The point I would add to this is a program that generally seizes cash because you need to declare more than $10,000 when you're heading out of the country. And, of course, drug traffickers are not. And occasionally, yeah, they are landing weapons. However, when you look at the data on, for example, Fast and Furious weapons seized in Mexico, the CBP's outbound inspection teams never actually got any. And I'm looking at ISA and Grassley's report on Fast and Furious here. All these weapons were being seized by the Mexican Army and Mexican Customs on the Mexican side of the port of entry.
Yeah, I was going to say, you have to when you come up to go into Mexico, there are signs all over the place: do not bring weapons into the country. So, into Mexico, that is.
Well, thank you guys for helping us define botched. Ted Robbins, NPR's National Desk correspondent based in Tucson, and Michelle Marisco, Tucson Senior Field Correspondent for the Fronteras Desk. Thanks very much. Coming
up, you.
Reginald
You're
Daniel
welcome.
Created one of the first courses on multicultural identity 20 years ago. He'll join us in just a moment. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.